Hi, and welcome to the Indie Music Podcast, the podcast for independent musicians and other music professionals. We're your hosts, myself, Matt Denton, also known as Mojo, of Ragged Birds Music. I'm a recording artist and mix engineer. And Douglas Reynolds of Resonance Studio, a mastering and recording engineer.
Hey, Matt. How you doing? Your levels are great. But how, really, how is your level?
How is my level? That's a great question. How's my level? It's pretty depleted.
Yeah.
I made it till Friday. You made it till Friday. I know you had a rough day yesterday. Today.
Yeah, it's all behind.
I just realized as I'm going over my notepad here that somehow I was like, this was like one of the busiest days ever. And my to-do list is longer than when I started.
Well, you'll have a busy next week or weekend. Hopefully not.
Yeah. I have some stuff for this weekend. But yes, Friday we made it. I'm back in my quote unquote office area. House guests have moved on to the next leg of their journey. I didn't bring my squeaky chair back. I'm in a different chair, but it probably squeaks too. But
who was it that said house guests are like fish?
That's Benjamin Franklin, one of my idols. House guests and fish stink in 3 days. Yeah. No, they good people, but you know, when we're already crammed in a house, you can't go anywhere, and then you have more people disrupting the flow. It's, you know,
yeah,
it's an adjustment.
So it is. It's nice, but yeah, it takes some effort.
Takes some effort, and this was a week where effort was already being put into many ways. I will be so glad when next week is over. Anyway, that's a whole different story. How are you? How's your level?
My level is good. I was thinking earlier in the last few episodes, it's been, I'm tired or, yeah, you know, long day and whatever. And I was like, what's this negativity stuff, you know? So I need to like change this whole like attitude thing. And I'm great, man.
I feel that too when I say it. And yet, you know, I'm just trying to be real.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not, you know, I'm not going down a rabbit hole. I'm not, you know, circling the drain or anything, but you know, it was a busy week. I will say that once again, this is one of the highlights of my week, of my day, and it gives me pause. It gives me fresh energy. It makes me, you know, take a breath and go,
yeah,
I get to talk to Doug and we get to talk about music and I get to forget all that other stuff for, you know, 30 to 45 minutes, whatever.
Yeah.
So big smoker plans. I feel like I want to ask that now every week. What do you got going on the smoker this week?
We're going to go out to a socially distanced, I guess it's minor league baseball game.
Oh, nice.
This weekend. And I've got a road trip planned on Sunday, which is why I had to post or basically cancel this week's audio mix chat.
Because
I'm going to be actually driving on the road during that normal time. So,
is it far?
I'm going to be driving and visiting and driving some more for about, I don't know, 7 or 8 hours.
Oh my.
On Sunday.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. I haven't done that for a while. Although I will be driving to LA at the end of the month. It sounds like I will be going down and helping my son move to a new apartment.
Oh, right on.
So that'll be a little adventure. It'll be nice. It'll be nice.
Yeah. The schools here, well, my son's in college now, but the all the high schools have just announced that it's 100% remote this year.
Yeah.
Or at least this
for the
fall.
Whole year?
Yeah. I think for just this fall. The university is, I don't know, just a larger percentage of the time unless it's absolutely necessary. I think my son is 100% remote for all of his classes, but then has to go on site for some labs.
Right. Yeah, I think that's how our schools are too. Our universities are some labs have to be in person, but then everything else is remote. And I think along the lines of going to definitely be remote for fall and the option of continuing remote for the rest of the year without a full commitment. But we're pretty sure they're not going anywhere.
Let's put it in terms of music. So like music instruction, or if you were a music student, it's pretty common to, I mean, I think most kids, young adults today would be very familiar with remote learning music lessons, you know, and remote teachers.
I agree. Yeah. I mean, I know people who've been doing like Skype lessons Now Skype's not really a thing anymore.
Yeah.
Everybody does Zoom or Teams or whatever, but yeah, Skype guitar lessons. I think some of those things are easier than others, but
yeah. I mean, I still have a teacher and take remote lessons at least once a month.
Yeah. Yeah. They seem to have adapted pretty well. My kids anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. From what I can tell, it's the teachers who are making a fuss around here and not the students. The students are fine. So the teachers are like, I don't want to do that.
Yeah. For those teachers that may not be as technically and remote technology adept, you know, that's going to be a lot of work for them to ramp up.
Yeah. My point is that they've had since March to realize that this was a very strong possibility as a scenario. And, you know, for people to say that they don't have time now to transition. Well, you've had 5 months.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's a whole different thing, but.
Like the university here. They were already, they already had like 60% requirements on remote learning in the classroom since several years ago.
Oh, yeah, you mentioned that. I think that's really progressive.
Yeah. So I don't think there was much of a high level of effort in order to pivot to meet the remote requirements from the university here.
Yeah, at some point, their universities are going to find out that it saves them money to not have to staff classrooms in person.
I know. I think about all the infrastructure that they have and the buildings and maintenance and everything else that goes along with it that's really not going to be needed as much anymore. I mean, the classrooms are going to remain cleaner.
Right.
It's just going to be maintaining things, and the air conditioning isn't going to have to run as often, you know, things like that. So, I mean, I think there's probably a lot of cost savings that could be associated with it too.
Yeah, I would imagine, at least for the next couple of years. But, you know, one thing that probably is difficult to do remote learning is piano, wouldn't you say, or would you think?
It depends if it's an acoustic grand piano or if it's like a, you know, some type of synth or keyboard. I think you'd be a little bit easier if it were, you know, some sort of electronic instrument.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are using electronic keyboards. So this was my attempt at doing a Doug transition to our topic tonight, which
it was better than mine. I was going to try and like segue from like a computer keyboard into like
continuing on our trip down recording and mixing lane with the next step in the progress, which I think would be keyboards.
Yeah.
I've never recorded live keyboards. You said that you had. I thought that you could tell us a little bit about that to begin.
I've recorded grand piano on site on the client's venue, but and then front of house stuff for regular keyboards.
Now, I've read about different, I guess, philosophies, different methodologies of recording a grand piano. And some people say that it should not be in stereo. Some people say that it should. What's your take on how to record a piano?
I use a pair of small diaphragm condensers up at the over the top of the hammers in kind of a Y configuration.
Okay.
And spread out a little bit because I'm trying to get coverage across the width of the piano. And then there's an iron plate on a grand piano, which is further away at the tailpiece. And that usually has a series of holes in the iron plate, which I think the main purpose of that is to reduce weight, but it probably has some acoustic properties as well. This was a trick that I had picked up from Warren Hurt. And by accident, he was recording a grand piano once, and they didn't realize that their microphone that was recording at the tail end of the grand piano had actually dropped down during the session. Oh. And it fell perfectly into one of the holes in the iron plate.
Oh, funny.
And he said it was one of the best sounding recordings he'd ever gotten. I had heard that before I did the recording on this grand piano. And so I decided I'm going to do that as well. So I took a large diaphragm condenser and set it down inside the largest hole of the iron plate. And then I use just a regular SM57 underneath the piano. And that's to get the lower boomier type of
sure.
of ambience from the piano itself. So that's how I like to set up. There's a lot better mics for grand piano than my pair of small diaphragm condensers across the hammer area. You know, you can put like four or five. They're probably still like small diaphragm condenser microphones, but setting those across to get a really wide spectrum. So, I mean, you could certainly end up having 6 to 8 microphones, you know, just on the one grand piano.
That sounds like a lot.
Yeah. And so with regards to stereo, that would be however you want to set it up. But the way that I did it, since I had the stereo match pair, is those were my left and right. And then the large diaphragm condenser was brought up the middle and the SM57 was brought up the middle and blended in.
It sounds kind of like that iron plate, which I had never heard of that before, but it sounds like that kind of acts as a resonator.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really, you know, it's just a really heavy, dense iron plate. So it's definitely that for sure. But again, I don't know if the holes are actually cast into that iron plate for acoustic properties or for simply to reduce the weight of that plate.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was wondering how adding an iron plate would reduce the weight, but you're saying the holes are the,
yeah,
reducing the weight. Well, it sounds like for that particular instance, that recording instance, the piano was very much a featured instrument.
Yeah. Actually it was soloed.
So yeah.
There was nothing else going on in the recording.
Cause I'm thinking that's, may not be that common if it's just one of many instruments to put that many microphones on a piano.
Yeah.
I feel like I want to ask Champion how she mics her piano. She's mostly voice, but, and did you then do left, right, and center, with your mix on that?
Yeah. And the left and right was not hard panned by any means. I don't really remember, but knowing me, it was probably around 20 or 25%. Max.
Yeah, that sounds about right. And then you treated it probably with some like room reverb or something, or did you have a room microphone as well?
No, I didn't have a room microphone on that one. Would have been nice, again, you know, from like a couple condenser mics hanging down or something like that from, you know, that you might typically see in a, like in an orchestra type of situation.
Right.
No, this was a smaller room, and so I just used what I had on the piano, didn't room mic that one. And as far as post-processing, yeah, I'm sure I did. I don't remember what my chain was on that, but typically EQ and maybe some reverb, maybe some light compression, and that's probably about it. I'm usually searching for the same thing on acoustic guitars to just capture the instrument and,
right,
and do little to it, you know, in the post-processing, because the instrument kind of holds up, you know, itself.
Sure.
And, so really it's just a matter of whatever corrections needed and adding whatever kind of room you think you might need in it. If you don't have like an overall ambience that you'd like, you know, of course, if you were recording in a larger room or a theater or something like that, you're going to have that
Abbey
naturally.
Road.
Yeah.
Capturing the room.
Capturing room mics. And
yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to think. I don't think I've ever mixed a song where the piano was like the featured instrument.
No.
I've mixed songs where it's like, you know, comes in through the chorus or the outro, or it's an accompanying instrument. And my experience with that is that, when we talked about acoustic guitar, even more so, a piano can eat the entire frequency spectrum, essentially,
right,
and just kind of overwhelm a mix. I'm doing some production consulting right now for somebody who's just doing voice and piano. And I believe it's a MIDI keyboard, you know, it's an electronic copy of a real piano, but in the DAW, it's a, what do you call it? Just an electronic instrument. Yeah, it's pretty overwhelming, just by itself. And I kind of wanted to go there a little bit in terms of, treating it as a featured instrument versus treating it as an accompanied instrument, and what you need to do EQ wise to either put it front and center, but keep it out of the way of the vocals, or, treat it so that it's not eating up, like taking over everything.
Right.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I'm thinking of Warren Hewitt was talking about a particular piano that he recorded that was kind of like a janky upright. And I think that's how he referred to it. It was like a janky upright piano.
Oh, yeah.
That just had, it wasn't necessarily 100% in tune, but it had such character that it really kind of transformed the song that it was a part of. And that's where something like a keyboard becomes really interesting as almost like a character actor, or, you know, that comes on set and just kind of steals a scene. But, yeah, I thought that was pretty fascinating that he was talking about the character and how it was imperfect and how that really kind of changed the song and the flavor of the song, because it did have such kind of slightly offbeat character. And I thought that was pretty interesting, especially in a world where you can play a MIDI keyboard and quantize all the notes and, you know, oh no, I don't like this setting. This is a Yamaha studio piano. I'm going to change this to a baby grand piano in my DAW and have it just be sound like a completely different instrument, which is great. And I think a lot of people are doing that right now at home because, you know, who can fit a piano in their apartment, right?
Right.
Let alone record it properly, let alone play it whenever you want to, frankly. So I know a lot of people are composing on electronic and MIDI keyboards and maybe mixing those for the first time and wondering why they can't hear their vocals too well.
Yeah. I think the thing is, and especially in the context of mixing, the piano is basically right down the line of the acoustic guitar as far as frequency spectrum. And also, it's all over the electric guitar, too. Additionally, it's all over the vocals.
Yeah.
And it encroaches into, depending on how the player is playing, it encroaches into the bass player's realm as well.
It steps on everything, essentially. Yeah.
And so the thing is that this is where song arrangement is really important.
Yes.
And where the individual musicians are covering, okay? Because even though the piano player can, she needs to keep it open for the bass player and let the bass player have the low end. Same thing like with a guitar. So, you know, when you want to bring all these instruments together, everybody has a part. And those parts need to work together.
Right.
And so I think that's the first most important thing is how you've actually arranged the different parts for the song so that everybody's kind of playing in their own space. And there's no reason, you know, for the electric guitar to be hammering down into the bass area when it's covered by the bass and the piano. And the piano and the bass player need to work it out too. What you end up having is a need for defining these are supporting instruments,
right,
of the song. They're not the lead, okay? And if it's a vocal song and we want to have the vocals up front, then we have to clear the space to allow the vocals to be where they're supposed to be for that mix. In some cases, and especially in older mixes, that may not have been exactly the case. It may have been that we were looking to get the vocals blended in level with the other instruments.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then it's even more important that everybody takes their own area and stays out, you know, and plays well together.
Oh yeah.
In order to get a mix like that, because, you know, if everybody's playing at the same level, you don't have volume to help you bring the singer more out front. Everybody, if everything's kind of blended together.
Right. Yeah. That's such an excellent point. And I remember when I was doing post on our last episode and the guitars, I remembered that was something that I wanted to bring up about how it's always such a struggle to get the electric guitars and vocals to play together. And I had meant to bring up that some of that is arranging, and you shouldn't be having somebody doing a guitar solo under somebody trying to sing a complicated line. That's an arrangement problem. That's not a mixing problem. That's something that you need to fix at the outset. That's why, you know,
I agree.
That's why there's kind of like a call and response very frequently with, you know, somebody sings and then a guitar sting and then they sing more and the guitar sting and underneath that is bass drums and maybe like a, you know, palm muted something or other so that the other parts can shine when it's time for them to shine. A piano, I'm thinking of really
dynamics
seasoned,
and fills and things
yeah,
like
really
that.
Yeah, really seasoned piano players who play and sing at the same time, they will kind of do that themselves. They'll play a little softer when they're singing, and then in between the lines, you know, they'll hit some, you know, stronger notes, and then they'll swell up, and then they use a lot of dynamics and a lot of the pedals to do sustain and stuff. But they kind of get out of their own way a little bit. And I wonder if people who are composing at home and maybe are not accompanying themselves have that kind of thing in mind when they're composing.
Yeah, I wonder. It also depends if they're, when they're composing or even recording, if they're playing the piano line at the same time that they're singing, or if they do that in two separate sessions, you know, for right. a vocal session and a piano session, in which case you may not have that continuity of dynamics unless you've really rehearsed it a lot, you know, ahead of time, and how the piano is gonna move in and out with the vocals.
Yeah, that's a good point. I compose on guitar, so I don't know.
That's where oftentimes the mix engineer's job in automation is to help make that happen.
Right, to make it sound like it was played more dynamically.
Yep.
Yeah, I was going to say something. I forget what I was going to say. But yeah, I think that composition and arrangement is a huge thing. When I'm mixing piano as a kind of, I don't know, like a color instrument, like you bring it in, or even an organ or something, I do oftentimes take out a lot of the bottom end, like maybe more than you'd think, because maybe you don't need all that getting in the way of the bass and the drums and the and everything else, and all you really want is kind of like the, you know, the middle to high accents, you know, tinkling away as a, you know, kind of an accompanying melody or harmony line. Yeah, I'm trying to think how different I would treat it if it was more of a featured instrument. Maybe I would start working on that much sooner, so that I could build the other parts around it rather than the other way around.
Yeah, it makes sense, you know, especially if it were acoustic piano. It's more rounded, and you know, you're not dealing with the transients that you would be like with an electronic keyboard. And depending on what sounds that keyboard is making, I mean, certainly there's some really great synths with grand piano sounds and stuff like that. That
yeah, some of them are really realistic sounding. Yeah. Especially if you, I like to take them and run them through. You know, some color EQ and get a little reverb on them. And sometimes, you know, if you do that right, you get some saturation on there, and you don't make it too perfect. Yeah, you can. I mean, you can hardly tell the difference. And if you can't tell the difference, you know, what difference does it make, right?
Yeah,
it doesn't have to be a real piano. It just needs to sound like a piano.
Right. And like I said, like the acoustic guitar and even some of the electric guitar, you're really looking at the three main areas of EQ, with a fourth being for cleaning out mud. That low area of the around the 80 hertz area, and then the mid area and the 250-ish, and 2 to 5K for, or even higher, for the presence of the piano.
Mm-hmm.
It may depend on what kind of piano there too. So, you know, if it's an upright versus a grand piano,
right?
What the timbre of that instrument is, but those are the main areas to kind of focus in EQing. And certainly, you know, that 2 to 5K, well, that's right down there with acoustic and with your vocals. And so there's going to be decisions being made across the entire the entire spectrum of right. frequencies here, you know, like we said in the beginning. So you'll really need to make some decisions up front as to, you know, what is the role of the piano in this composition, and how do you want to feature it? That will help you decide, am I going to boost, you know, at 3K so that I can bring that more up front or not? Or do I want it to settle down? You know, how do you want to bring that mix? Will I adjust it with level and keep it a little bit below? So those are things you'll just have to kind of work out while you're doing the mix.
Yeah, that's all true. I have a feeling that, and now I feel like I want to go listen to some, you know, old Billy Joel and some Elton John and stuff like that, and just kind of see how they worked it out. But I feel like in in a lot of the pop music, the piano is mixed thinner than you probably expect it to be. And some of that other stuff that you think might be the piano is actually other pads and other electronic kind of sounds in there that aren't actually the piano, because they fill out the song but don't get in the way of the vocals the way that all those other notes would.
Yeah. Think about like Van Halen Jump. And
oh, yeah.
Maybe that was a DX7 or something like that, I think. And how that intro came out, and as soon as David Lee Roth came in,
oh, he that cut piano right part.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a pretty lush sounding electronic keyboard, whatever that was.
Yeah. I gotta bet that was the era of the DX7.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was some great keyboard sounds in the 80s, and those are all kind of coming back right now. I see a lot of 70s and 80s electronic emulations coming through, and in my daily emails of these plugins are on sale, these instruments are, oh, I got like three of them today. No, four. I got like four emails today between Waves and PSP Audioware, Plugin Alliance and all these. But yeah, there's all these emulations now, all these great, you know, Moog and Korg and
yeah,
these other keyboards. I think those are, in a year, we're going to hear just a ton of 80s sounding stuff. It's going to be cool.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to it, actually.
You know, when I think of these guys and the synth players and their studios, it's really like, I get this picture of Dr. Frankenstein. And, I, you know,
yes.
I can't make sense of what they're really got going on there with a full wall of synthesizers and,
oh yeah, I don't even know what
that patch is. Cables and how they can even in their minds sort all of that out and then change it dynamically, right, as part of their composition. It's just really impressive to me, honestly.
It's, I mean, truly mind blowing. It just really, I would just like to sit and watch that one day. Just kind of sit and watch somebody play with all that stuff. So I'll never own it, but you're right. It sure is fascinating. Yeah, that's definitely making a comeback too. People collecting all those analog, you know, jack in this, jack in that, plugging all these things. And yeah, for some reason that they could probably explain to you really quickly, you have to have a wall of them.
It's true. No.
You can't just have like one or two little components. You got to have a whole wall of them.
I want a wall of rack effects, you know.
Yeah.
I understand the need for the wall of things, but it's the using that wall of things as one entire instrument that is just mind blowing to me.
Yeah. So, yeah.
I think that's really the gist of it though. I mean,
I wanted to say one more thing, which is that I think because you know, MIDI is math. And each one of those keystrokes is defined as in terms of, you know, velocity and a note, and then, you know, it can be transcribed very quickly between electronic instruments in your DAW. But when you start to stack a lot of those things up, and your computer clock has to keep track of all of that math in addition to everything else it's doing, you can kind of, I mean, I've seen in Logic, when you have too much stuff going on, it'll say the clock error synchronizing MIDI and audio. You know, you can overtax your computer doing too much MIDI keyboard stuff. So if you get a part and you get it set and you're ready to send it off to somebody to mix it or whatever, it's good to bounce that down to an audio file, I think, and not try to send somebody MIDI.
My opinion on that is the same, in that the only reason that you'd want to send off MIDI is if you're going to send it to somebody where they're going to do more work on it in MIDI.
Right.
But once you go to mix, I think the preference should always be in working in audio.
Right.
Because you've already done the work. You know, we're not looking at the post-production point of changing anything that occurred, you know, in the MIDI track.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, I wonder if there's a scenario where, you know, like we were talking about reamping. I've heard of people say leaving the leaving the guitar tones up to the producer or mixer.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering if somewhere out there there's somebody thinking that they'll leave the final you know, MIDI keyboard tones to the mixer or producer. And I think that's probably not a good idea.
Yeah. You know, why not provide them, but maybe provide both. You know, maybe the producer somewhere along the line that goes, you know what, this needs to have a different instrument attached to the you know, to the MIDI. So they want to, they don't really want to change the plane at all, but whatever sounds or plugins were used on it, maybe want to change those and apply those to that track in MIDI so that they can do that type of thing. Maybe sending both. Personally, you know, I've never received MIDI, so it's always come to me as audio.
Yeah, I just did. That's why I brought it up. Oh, I don't usually work, you know, full project swaps, but I'm trying that out right now just for interest, because I'm helping some people learn, you know, get their feet wet with Logic, so kind of want.
And that may be it too. Is that you have someone who just they know how to record their MIDI, but they don't know how to bounce and do some of those type of things. So they're just sending you what they have. You know?
Yeah.
In which case, that's fine.
I'm using it as a teachable moment.
Yeah.
But I wanted to see what they're doing first.
But it's not a big deal. I mean, you receive those and it takes a few minutes to bounce those out to audio. No biggie, you know? So
yeah,
it's not like I would reject it.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that there is, I feel like there's more of a margin for error when you're trading MIDI files between computers than if you were trading audio files.
Well, when you get the MIDI files, then you're not getting the plugins that they had.
True.
What sound are you going to apply to that to make sure it sounds like what they wanted?
Exactly. In this case, it's a stock
plugin. All you have is data,
plugin, you know? And we have the same, yeah.
So yeah, so that would be the caveat. And since you have the same synth plugin as the musician that sent it to you, you're going to be able to apply that and get exactly the same result that they had. If you didn't have, you wouldn't be able to do that.
Exactly. Yeah. So just something to think about.
Yep. Good point.
Other than that, yeah, I think it's interesting to think about how you would treat it as a featured instrument versus how you would treat it as a you know, color instrument or accompanying instrument.
I think in terms of that, just think in the same line of thought as I would other instruments. And, you know, like I would treat it like guitar in that respect as to how it sits in the mix and interacts with other instruments and vocals.
Agree. Cool. Are we going to do, when we get to vocals, is that going to be a series? Because I feel like that could be, it could be interesting.
I mean, it could be. I mean, I think we've got an interview coming up that's going to break up the series here.
That'll give us a chance to think about it.
Yeah.
Well, I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, likewise. So that should be fun. And I have to get a little bit more information on that. And but I think we have a calendar date set, and then I need to get information about the interview topic and things like that. We'll be looking for that probably a week after this episode comes out.
Okay, cool. Well, that's exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah, we haven't done an interview for a little while.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward
Mix
to it.
Mix it up.
Excellent. All right. Well, thanks as always, Doug.
Yeah, thank you. And thanks,
enjoy
listeners.
Enjoy your weekend. And
I will. You talk too. To you soon.
Thanks, everybody. Appreciate you.
Cheers.
Cheers. Well, that's it for another episode of the Indie Music Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. If you did, leave us a comment or a review and share with your friends. Hit us up on our website at indiemusiccast.com. Find myself on Twitter at Mojo's Army. Find Douglas on Twitter at Rezo Studio. Thanks. Until next time, keep creating.